Chapter 11. Holy Omotu. Of all the cants, none better illustrates the nature of the soul than the cants of compulsion. According to Zarathinius, the fact that those compelled unerringly think themselves free shows that volition is one more thing moved in the soul, and not the mover we take it to be. While few dispute this, the absurdities that follow escape comprehension altogether. Maremnus, The Arcana Implicata. As a miller once told me, when the gears do not meet, they become as teeth. So it is with men and their machinations. Antillus, On the Folly of Men. Early Spring, 4112, Year of the Tusk, Omotu. They had come from the straw-floored manors of Galioth, where dogs supped with their masters, from the frontier forests of Thunieris, deep and great, where the Srank waged their aimless and eternal war, from the mead halls of Setadon, where long-haired thanes denounced mongrel races, from the great estates of Conraya, where dark-eyed palatines made prizes of their pasts, and from the sultry plains of High Anon, where painted caste nobles beat paths through teeming streets. 8 seasons previously, the Shrya of the Thousand Temples had called, and they had come, the men of the Tusk. From Garotha, they continued their march across a subdued land. Word of the warrior prophet's toll of days had outrun them, and wherever they passed, they found Zarashi prostrate across the red and black earth. Hidden granaries were thrown open, goat milk, honey, dried peppers, and sugar cane, even entire herds of cattle were willingly surrendered. Village elders acclaimed them, kissed their sandaled feet, and presented the most fair of their dark-skinned daughters, anything that might appease the lords of the Holy War. The main column, consisting of Holwarga, Kinjosa, Proyas, and Anfarig, followed the Herotic Way. One by one the coastal strongholds surrendered to them, Sabsal, Moradon, and even Horepo, which had been a primary port of destination for Inrithi pilgrims in the years preceding the Holy War. More newcomers joined them, seafaring Galioth, Oswenta men, for the most part, driven ashore by Kianine marauders. Sweating in their hair shirts, they hauled their barks onto the rocky strands and burned them. They joined their kinsmen about their evening fires, only to be troubled by their strange garb and implacable stares. Gothyelk, meanwhile, struck directly south to invest the great fortress of Cargido, using the intelligence provided by Athgieri to secure his approach. Even here, word of the massacre at Garotha had reached the heathen in advance, and after a largely ceremonial show of defiance, the famed citadel gave herself over to the uncertain mercy of the Tidoni. "Most holy prophet," the Earl of Agansinor would write, "Cargido has fallen, and with nary a death save that of my cousin's nephew, who was taken by a stray shaft. Verily, you have boned this land like a fish. Praise be the God of gods. Praise be Inri Sejanus, our prophet, your brother." With each passing day, the sorrows of the long road seemed to fall away, and the men of the Tusk recalled their old humor. Evenings became celebrations, pious bacchanals, where toast after toast would be raised to their hallowed warrior prophet. Hundreds of impromptu pilgrimages set out across the lush countryside, and the Zarashi wondered at these idolaters, who continually roamed ground, stumped by ruins, arguing over passages in their scriptures. Save for a handful of incidents, there were no atrocities like those that marred their earlier marches. In the councils of great and lesser names, the warrior prophet made it clear that the Inrithi either kept or betrayed his word with their actions. "The Zarashi," he said, "need not love me to trust me, just as we need not murder them to demonstrate our hate. Spare them, and their gates will be opened. Kill them, and you kill your brothers." Though Zarash had been emptied of Kianine, Athgieri found himself sorely pressed in Holy Omotu. All across the Jarta Highlands, distant streamers of smoke plied the skies as the Fainim hastened to burn any and all structures possessing timber that could be used for siege engines. Taking Mare Parassus as his base, The brash young earl ranged to the very edges of the Sherazor plains, visiting ruin upon the Fainim where he could. But after each encounter he returned with more empty saddles, until very soon his 500 thanes and knights had dwindled to fewer than 200. Though he possessed daring in excess, he lacked the manpower required to secure his position, let alone fence with Fenial and the heathen army that concentrated about Shima. His missives to the warrior prophet, which had begun as dispassionate appraisals of the situation in the field, soon became pleas for assistance. The warrior prophet begged patience and fortitude, even as he exhorted the great names to hasten their march. The main column climbed into the Jarta Highlands some 10 days following the fall of Garotha, a remarkable pace given the size of the train, which included the perennially slothful Scarlet Spires, and the fact that they foraged as they marched. Then something peculiar happened. Accounts of the incident would vary greatly, though all agreed that it involved an encounter between an old man, an old blind man, and the warrior prophet. This in itself was extraordinary, since the 100 pillars were at great pains to either drive away, or failing that, kill every blind man found in the path of the sacral retinue. The nearer the holy war drew to Shima, the more the warrior prophet's consort and intricati feared the possibility of a Kishorim attack. Apparently, a blind Zarashi beggar had been overlooked, and as the sacral retinue passed through the Jartic town of Gim, he cried out to the warrior prophet. In a letter to his father, Prince Nersei Proyas would write the following description. No one understood what he said, though Arishal and the other bodyguards understood the danger well enough. They immediately charged toward the man, only to be brought up short by the resounding crack of the warrior prophet's voice. Everyone stood milling, confused, while the Blessed One regarded the shambling old beggar. The man's skin was almost black, so that his wild hair and beard seemed as white as a Zayumi's teeth. As we watched, quite astonished, the Blessed One dismounted and walked toward the old man, as though he were the penitent. When he towered over the bent figure, he asked, "Who are you to make demands?" To which the remarkable fool replied, "One who has something to whisper into your ear." Cries of alarm erupted among us. I know I, Father, was concerned to the point of terror. "And why," the Blessed One asked, "must you whisper?" To which the man responded, "Because my words are the words of my doom. Truthfully, you will kill me after you hear them." I know I shouted that this was a trick of some kind, some foul Kishorim deceit, and I know there were many such shouts of apprehension, but the Blessed One did not listen. He even kneeled, Father, to one knee, so that the blind man could better reach his ear. We sat motionless, gutted by horror, while he whispered his doom. And it was his doom, Father, for no sooner had he finished than the warrior prophet drew Enshoya, his holy sword, and struck the miscreant down, cutting him from his collar to his heart. We had scarcely recovered our breaths when he commanded that the holy war halt and make camp across the fields of Gim. And to those who dared ask for an explanation, he would say nothing. What did the old fool whisper? There had been a time when he'd walked in glory and horror, spear-bearer to mighty Sil, the great king after the fall. He had dared the wrath of Kujara Kinmoy on the plains of Pir Pahal. He had ridden the back of Wutiat, father of dragons. He had wrestled Kyogli the mountain, thrown him from his feet. Sarpanur, the non-men of Ishriel, had called him at first, after the keystone that fixed their crude subterranean arches. And then, following the womb plague, Sin-Pharion, the angel of deceit. Ah, the raucous glory of that age. He had been young then, before the accretions of graft after graft had sapped his monumental frame. And such a contest. But for Sil's impatience, he and his brothers would have won, and all this world, would be moot. Driven from Min Uroikas, scattered, hunted, so far they had dwindled. And then, from nowhere, a second age of glory. Who would have guessed that the cunning of men could resurrect their aborted designs, that the vermin could restore his destiny? Horde general to dread Mog Farrow, breaker of worlds. He had burned the great library of Sauglish. He had stormed the heights of Holy Trice. He had made fires of their cities, beacons that shone through the very void. He had extinguished nations, bled whole peoples white. Aurang, the Norse Arai of Kunayori, had called him the Warlord, perhaps the most far-seeing of his many names. So how had it come to this? Bound to a Synthes, like a king to a leper's robes, frail and fugitive, skulking about the fires of a roused enemy? There had been a time when the screams of thousands had heralded his coming. He circled the hilltop compound the way a vulture might, slow and high, and with a patience that could run out all life. To the west, the hills of Jarta lay blanched and broken in the moonlight. To the east, the plains of Sherazor fanned to the black horizon, scored by grove and field, pocked by barn and byre. Beyond, the horde general knew, lay Shaima, the very heart of the Mannish world, the three seas. Everywhere he could see the furtive mark of their generations, the residue of once dominant themes and long-lost reprises, the shadows of the Shigeki fortress that had once commanded these heights, the Canaan road that struck straight as a rule across the plain, the defensive sensibilities of the Nansur in the compound's concentric design, the frosting of Kianine ornament, petaled battlements, iron-fretted windows. He was deeper than all this, older than their blasted stone. He spiraled downward toward the outer courtyard where he could see his children's horses. He alighted on one of the eaves where the sun's warmth still radiated from the clay tiles. He called to them in the sacred pitch only they and rats could hear. They came leaping through dark and abandoned halls, faithful, faithless things. They groveled before him, their groins slick from their victims. His eyes flared and they clutched themselves in anguish and ecstasy. His children, his flowers. For decades, the consult had assumed that the alien metaphysics of the Kisharim had been responsible for uncovering their children in Shaima. This had made the prospect of the Empire's fall to the Fainim intolerable. Half the three seas immune to their poison? The Holy War had seemed a rare opportunity. But the plate had changed all too quickly. To realize that the Kisharim were but a mask for a far more ancient foe, to come so very close, only to discover their sublime deception subverted by something deeper, something new, the Dunyane. There was more to this than a son hunting for his father, far more. Their devious methods and disconcerting abilities aside, these Dunyane were a Nasarimber. Even without the mandate prophecies, enmity was a fact of their accursed blood. Who was this Moengus? And if his son could seize the armed might of the three seas in a single year, what had he accomplished in 30? What awaited the holy war in Shaima? Despite the rank disorder of his soul, the Skilvendi had been right about one thing. These Dunyane had seized too much already. They could not be allowed the Gnosis as well. Aurang, his hoary soul wrenching at the seams of the Synthes that housed him, smiled an odd, bird-twitching smile. How long since his last true contest? His children continued straining and clutching, their cracked faces bent to the stars.
"Prepare this place," he commanded.
"But old father,"
the daring one, Usirta, said,
"how could you be certain?"
He knew. He was the warlord.
"The Anasarimba marches the Herotic way. He will pause before crossing the plain, reorganize, revise his plans. The Skilvendi is right. He isn't like the others."
A normal man, even an Anasarimba, would succumb to the eagerness that so quickened the legs of those who set eyes upon a hard-won destination, but not a Dunyane. Men, they had been little more than packs of wild dogs during the first wars. How had they grown so?
"Is it near, old father?"
the other, Maorta, exclaimed.
"Does it come?"
He regarded the piteous thing, his wretched instrument, and so few of them remained.
"The sacrifice has been made,"
he said, ignoring its question.
The Anassarimba will be lulled into thinking he has already anticipated us. Then, when he comes to this place...
Before the coming of these Dunyane, the consult could trust to their tools. Now, Orang had no choice but to intervene, to tyrannize what their tools could only mock, to possess what they could only mimic.
Trust me, my children. He will be caught unawares when we strike. This is where treachery is his wife's heart.
They would test the limits of this prophet's penetration. They would deny him the gnosis. The thing gurgled and clacked its teeth.
We probe their faces with pins,
Eleazarus said, affecting the droll tone that had once come so naturally to him.
And that was how you found him?
Her tone was sharp and obviously sarcastic. Eleazarus glanced derisively at Iacchus, even though all such looks were wasted upon him now. How little these menials knew of Janan.
Need I explain it again?
The painted lips smiled.
That depends whether he wishes to hear your story now, doesn't it?
Eleazarus snorted, availed himself of his wine bowl once again, drinking deep.
She was clever. He would seat her that. Damnably clever.
No. No need to bring him into this.
The fact that she had learned of their discovery so quickly spoke not only to her ability, but to the efficacy of the organization she had assembled following the warrior prophet's ascendancy. He would not make the mistake of underestimating either her or her resources again, this whore cum consort, this Esmanette. She was attractive, though, well worth rutting. To do to her what they had done to that thing's face? Yes, very attractive. The slaves had finished pitching the pavilion no more than a watch previously. Eleazarus had arrived with Iacchus to study the beast, the first live one they'd apprehended, when the Intricati had appeared in the wake of exclaiming and bewildered Javra. She had just walked in. One of the Nascenti accompanied her, Werjau or something. Eleazarus was too drunk to remember, as well as four of those 100 fucking pillars, all with Kore bound to their palms, of course. They stood, a small and confrontational crowd, framed by the evening light that filtered through the entrance. Eleazarus wondered if she even grasped the outrageousness of her presumption. Sweet Sejanus, they were the Scarlet Spires. No one simply intruded upon their affairs, no matter what their writ or who their lord and master, especially a woman. The chamber was both hot and foul, a result of all the felt the slaves had draped across the walls to muffle sound. Suspended face down, the thing lay shackled to the crude iron scaffold that propped the ceiling. A leather thong had been tied about the tip of each facial digit, drawing them out like the ribs of a parasol. In the corner of Eleazarus's eye, it looked a grotesque parody of the circumfix. Its crotch face glistened in the lantern light, wet and vaginal. Blood tapped the reed mats in a steady rhythm.
"We fully intended," Iacchus was saying, "to share any information we exacted."
Whether this was true or false, of course, depended entirely on the information exacted.
"Oh," the Intricati said. "I see."
Despite her small stature, she cut an imposing figure in her Kianine gown and wrap.
"And when might that have been?" she continued. "Sometime after Shima?"
Penetrating bitch. That was the thing, of course. The reason they had no hope of merely talking their way out of this small and likely inconsequential treachery. Shima lay mere days away. The impossible had become imminent. It was strange the way events had shown him the divisions in what had once been the singular morass of his soul. Even as he laughed at the thought of Shima and the Kishorim, something gibbered within him, panicked and sputtered, like that day his uncles had hauled him into the breakers to teach him how to swim.
"Some other day, please, some other day."
Where was the justice? His contract with Mathanet and the Thousand Temples had been struck in a different world. There had been no mention of the consult or the second apocalypse, no mention of the mandate being right, and certainly nothing had been said about a living prophet. How could they have been so deceived? And now, to be bent upon murder, to have their knife drawn, only to discover that they had no motive except self-preservation? What have I done? For weeks now, the members of the Scarlet Spire's Privy Council, the Two Palms, had quarreled over question after question. Is the Atrathal Prince truly a prophet? And if he is, why should the Scarlet Spires accede to his demands? And what of the Second Apocalypse, the Consult, and their skin spies? They had replaced Kefaramuni. They had ruled High Anon in their name. What did that portend? And how should they respond? Should they retreat? Abandon the Holy War? What would be the consequences of that? Or should they continue prosecuting their war against the Kishorum? Burning questions, and all of them with no answer, apart from decisive leadership, something that their present Grand Master clearly lacked. The insinuations had already started, the niggling comments that accused all the more for their ambiguity. Curse the implications! He felt like screaming at Inrumi, Zerosthenes, and the others. Just say what you mean! That said it all, he supposed. What was it the Conryan said about an Enanai demanding clarity? It meant throats would be soon cut. And Iacchus especially had become quarrelsome, despite the fact that Eleazarus had renamed him to his old position. Who'd ever heard of a blind master of spies? Even before the bitch Intricati's arrival, the Canv addict had started, demanding that Eleazarus parse the undecidable, that he recall his station, treat with the new fanatics, as he called them, from a position of strength.
Don't say it, Eleazarus had cried. Don't even think it.
So what? Are we to simply endure these indignities? You would yield our...
He sees, Iacchus. He reads our souls in our faces. What you say to me, you say to him, no matter what. All he need ask is, what does your master of spies make of all this? And no matter what answer I give him, he will hear these very words you speak. Fah!
There was strength in ignorance, Eleazarus realized. All his life, he had thought knowledge a weapon. The world repeats, the Sherratic philosopher Umartu had written. Know these repetitions, and you may intervene. Eleazarus had taken this as his mantra, had used it as the hammer with which to pound cunning into his wit. You may intervene, he would tell himself, no matter what the circumstance. But there was knowledge beyond hope of intervention, knowledge that mocked, degraded, gelded, and paralyzed, knowledge that only ignorance could contradict. Iacchus and Inrumi simply did not know what he knew, which was why they thought him castrate. They didn't even believe. Perhaps it was inevitable that the Intricati appear here and now, that the warrior prophet intervene. And why wasn't I summoned? The Intricati was asking. Why was the warrior prophet not informed?
We thought it a school matter, Iacchus said.
A school matter?
Eleazarus smirked. It is we who face the snakeheads, not you.
She actually had the temerity to take a step closer. These things have nothing to do with the Kishorum, she snapped.
I would ponder that word, we, Eleazarus. I assure you its meaning is more treacherous than even you might think.
Impertinent, outrageous, impertinent whore!
Fah! He cried. Why am I even speaking to the likes of you?
Her eyes flashed. The likes? Something, her tone, or perhaps his own better judgment, caused him to reconsider. He felt his contempt drain away, his eyes dull with anxiety. He blinked, looked to the skin spy, which writhed in the constrained way of couples making love with only blankets to conceal them. Suddenly, everything seemed so dreary, so hopeless.
I apologize, he said.
Out of habit, he had tried to sound scathing, but the words had sounded scared instead. What was happening to him? When would this nightmare end? A smile of triumph crept across her face. She, a caste menial whore. Eleazarus could feel Iacchus stiffen in outrage. Apparently, one did not need eyes to witness what had just happened. Consequences.
Why must there always be consequences? He would pay for this humiliation. To remain the Grand Master, one had to act the Grand Master. What did I do wrong? Something churlish cried within.
The creature will be transferred, she was saying. These things have no soul for your cants to compel. Other means are required.
She spoke the language of edict, and Eleazarus found himself understanding, though Iacchus, he knew, could not hope to follow. She was a handsome woman, beautiful even. He would enjoy fucking her, and the fact that she belonged to the warrior prophet, sugar on the peach, as the Nansur would say.
The warrior prophet, she continued, speaking his name like a well-worn threat, wishes to know the details of your prep.
Is what they say true?
He blurted.
Is it true you once belonged to Acarmian? Drusus Acarmian?
Of course he knew it was, but for some reason he needed to hear her say it. She stared at him, dumbfounded. Suddenly, Eleazarus could actually hear the silence provided by the black felt walls, every stitch of it.
Tap, 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 tap.
The thing bleeding faceless blood.
Don't you see the irony? He drawled on. Surely you do. I was the one who ordered that Acarmian be abducted. I was the one who stranded you with him.
He snorted.
I'm the reason you're here at all, am I not?
She didn't sneer. Her face was far too beautiful. But her expression burned with contempt nonetheless.
More men, she said evenly, should take credit for their mistakes.
Eleazarus tried to laugh, but she continued, speaking as though he were nothing more than a creaking pole or barking dog, noise. She continued telling him, the Grand Master of the Scarlet Spires, what he had to do, and why not, when he so obviously had abandoned decisions.
Shima was coming, she said. Shima. As though names could have teeth.
Rain. It was one of those showers that came sudden upon dusk, foreshortening the sunlight, and within moments casting the pall of woolen night. Water fell in sheets, vanishing into grasses, hissing across bare ground, bouncing across the dark welter of canvas slopes. Gusts made mist of the torrent, and sodden banners thrashed like fish on hooks. Hoarse shouts and curses echoed through the encampment. The delinquent battled to pitch their tents. Some few stripped and stood naked, letting the water cleanse the long, long road from their skin. Esmanette, like so many others, found herself running. She was thoroughly drenched by the time she found the small pavilion. Standing stoic in the downpour, the guardsmen of the Hundred Pillars could only regard her with bemused sympathy. The canvas flap was slicked and cold. Kellis already awaited her in the warmly illuminated interior, as did Acarmian. They both turned to her, though Acarmian looked quickly back to the abomination, the skin spy she had seized from Eleazarus. It seemed to be muttering to him. Rain drummed across the tarpaulin, an ambient and humid roar. Water dripped from dents in the ceiling. The thing had been chained upright to the centermost post, its wrists hung high, its feet off the rush-covered ground to deny it leverage. Nude, it gleamed polished brown in the lantern light, the color of the Sansori slave it had replaced. The wages of its captivity marred its skin. Burns, welts, and inexplicable curlicues of broken skin, as though a child had scribbled upon it with an awl or knife. Its face disjointed and half-clenched, it rolled its head as though dragging a weight. An expression of human astonishment seemed painted across its knuckled digits. Iacchus had taken his toll, she realized, even in such a short time. She tried not to think of Acarmian suffering the man's ministrations.
Chigra! Kurchnaka! Murkmuk! Sri!
Some inborn impulse, Acarmian was saying, as though he resumed an interrupted thought, like those caterpillars that curl into a ball whenever touched. The same must happen when they're captured. Shuddering, Esmanette bent over to squeeze water from her hair,
then gently dabbed her face with the inner lining of her surcoat, knowing from the stains that the lamp black about her eyes had scored her cheeks to the hollow. She blinked at the obscene image of the skin spy, tried to steady her breath. She had to harden herself to such things.
Who are you fooling?
Was this how it was for others of high station? Perpetual fear? From everything. Every word, every act. The consequences hung so heavy, swung so far and deep. The consult is real.
No, Kella said. You're understanding them by reference to men.
He shot Akami in a chiding smile that Esmanette found herself returning.
You're assuming they must possess some self to hide, but whatever subtlety of character they possess, they steal. Apart from that, they have only the bestial rudiments of self. They're shells only, the mockery of souls.
More than enough, Akamian replied, grimacing. The implications were clear. More than enough to replace us.
More than enough, Kellis repeated, though his intonations, regret, sorrow, foreboding, made them seem entirely different words.
Still quite sodden, Esmanette took her place by Kellis's side, making sure that he stood between her and Akamian. Suddenly, she found herself at the dizzying center of his attention.
The man it replaced, he asked. What was he?
She tried to purge the adulation from her look.
One of their slave soldiers, she replied. Javra. He belonged to the Roomkar.
A weeper, Akamian said, using the sorcerer's pejorative for Koray archers, those who shed the tears of God. The Roomkari, Esmanette had been told, were widely considered the most deadly marksmen in all the three seas. She nodded.
That was how he came to Eleazarus's attention, in fact. The Scarlet Spires encouraged liaisons between members of their most elite formations. His lover reported him to his superiors. Apparently, they probed his face with pins.
She looked to Kellis with what she had assumed would be pride, but felt like longing instead.
Effective, he said, nodding, but impractical on any useful scale.
Even though he didn't look at her, he gently squeezed her shoulder as he circled the monstrosity. The space between her and Akamian suddenly seemed nude.
So, what do you think? Akamian asked. Could we have caught them preparing for an assassination attempt?
Despite her discomfort, Esmanette turned to him, drawn by the quaver in his voice. He met her gaze for one round-eyed moment, then glanced away. The anxiousness never lifted, she realized, the horror of making mistakes that never went away.
Not for people like us. They know you bear the mark now, she said to Kellis. They think you vulnerable.
But the risks, Akamian said. I can't think of anyone the Scarlet Spire scrutinize more than their Roomkari. This thing's handler had to know as much.
Indeed, Kellis said. It implies desperation.
Unaccountably, she thought of that day in Sumna, arguing the significance of Mathanet's offer to the Scarlet Spires with Akamian and Inrau. The first day, men had listened.
But think, she said, rallying what confidence she could. Yours is the greatest soul, Kellis, the most subtle intellect. You've come to thwart the second apocalypse. Wouldn't they do anything to deny you the Gnosis? Anything?
Chigras.
The thing wheezed.
Putara Kizurat.
Akamian glanced at Kellis before turning to her with uncommon boldness. I think she's right, he said, gazing with open admiration. Maybe we can breathe easy, maybe not. Either way, we should probably keep you cloistered as much as possible. Though the patronage of his look should have offended her, there was apology in it as well. A heartbreaking admission. She could not bear it. Darkness and drumming rain. The thing lay motionless, though the scent of the guardsmen who doused the lanterns had pulled its phallus long and hard across its belly. The musk of terror. The shackles chafed, but it felt no pain. The air chilled, but it was not cold. It knew it had been sacrificed, knew the torments to come, yet it believed without contradiction that its old father would not abandon it. It had spoken long with its captive brothers,
It knew the numbers that would guard it, the elaborate codes that would be required to see it. It was doomed, without hope of reprieve, and yet it would be saved. Two certainties it could mull in what passed for its soul without any offense to consistency. There was but one measure, one truth, and it was warm and wet and bloody. The mere thought of it sent spasms through its member. How it yearned, how it ached. It hung in the twilight it called thought, dreamed of mounting enemies. When the apportioned time had passed, it jerked its head upright, and still groggy, fumbled to assemble its face. As though out of reflex, it tested its bonds and shackles. Metal whined, wood creaked. Then it screamed, though not in any register mannish ears might detect.
Yet, Mietzur!
Shrill and piercing, ringing out across the army of men who slept huddled against the damp and chill, to where its brothers crouched like jackals in the rain.
Jut jaga Mietzur!
Two words in a Gurtzoi, their holy tongue. They believe. From Gim, the holy war struck across the Jarda Highlands. None could read the steel that marked their passage into Omotu, though they somehow knew. Their scattered columns snaked across the dark and hazy hillsides, their arms and armor shining bright in the sunlight, their voices raised in booming song. They walked the ways of holy Omotu, and though the stacked landscape, with its pastures as flat as lakes across the valley floor, its slopes hunched about shale escarpments, was as novel as any they had crossed over the hard seasons, it seemed they had come home. Far more than Zerash, they knew this place, its names, its peoples, its history. They had been schooled in this earth since childhood. By mid-afternoon of the following day, the Kunrians had reached the Anothrite Shrine, which lay some 3 miles off the Herodic Way. 7 men, and Kiriothi under Palatine Genyati, were drowned in the rush to bathe in the holy waters. With each day they trudged or rode across some greater threshold, some other marker of their great labor's end. Soon they would be in Besral, where they might glimpse the blood of the latter prophet's line in the eyes of the inhabitants. Then the river Hor. Then, Shima, it seemed, lay impossibly near. Shima. Like a shout on the horizon, a whisper become voice in their hearts. Meanwhile, a few days' march to the east, the Padiraja himself, Fanail Ab Kaskamandri, took to the field with his several hundred Koyori and hand-picked grandees, bent on hunting down the man his people called Hural Akrit, a name they were forbidden to speak in his presence. Knowing that Athgieri's numbers had dwindled, he ordered Kinganjahoy to ride in force across the south of the highlands with his Umarnans. He guessed that the nimble earl would skirt the tiger's flank rather than withdraw, following the river Hor beneath the hoof-shaped hills the Kianin called the Madas, or the Nails. Here he prepared an ambush, using, much to the disgust of the High Heresiarch, Siokti, a full cadre of Kishorim to assure victory. The young Earl of Gainry, however, stood his ground, and though outnumbered 10-1, met Kinganjahoy and his grandees in pitched battle. Despite the ferocity of the Inrithi, the situation was hopeless. The red horse of Gainry vanished in the tumult. Crying out to his men, Athgieri spurred toward it, battled his way into the heathen's midst, cowing them with shouts and hammering blows. Without warning, his Mongolian charger faltered, and an adolescent lancer, the son of a Selukaran grandee, stabbed him in the face. Death came swirling down. The Fainim keened in ululating triumph. Howling in outrage and horror, the earl's householders charged into the heathen horseman who desperately tried to abscond with his body. At a horrible cost, the Galioth retrieved him, hacked and mauled, desecrated. Bearing his body, the surviving thanes and knights of Gainry fled westward, broken as few men could be. Within hours, they encountered a strong band of Kishati under Lord Soter, who scattered their pursuers. The Gainry wept to know that deliverance had been so near, yet so very late. They would be called the 20, for out of hundreds, no more than that number survived.
At the Council of Great and Lesser Names, the death of Athgieri occasioned solemn remembrance and no little dread. For so long the young earl had been the eyes of the Holy War, the longest and surest of their many lances. It was a disastrous omen. Since Cumhor, the high cultist of Gilgeol, was dead, the warrior prophet himself conducted the ceremony, declaring him battle celebrant, speaking the Gilgalic rites without rehearsal. Inri Sejanus came after the apocalypse, he told the grieving caste nobles, when the world's wounds had need of healing. I come before, when men have need of warlike strength. Of all the hundred gods, far-striking Gilgeol burns brightest within me, but not so bright as he burned within Coethus Athgieri, son of Asilda, daughter of Eryit, king of the Galioth. Afterward, the surviving priests of war washed his body and dressed him in clothing belonging to his recently arrived countrymen, so he wouldn't suffer the indignity of burning in the kalats of his enemy. He was laid upon a great pyre of cedar and set alight, a lone beacon beneath the arch of heaven. The dirges of the Galioth echoed long into the night. The Holy War crossed the last of the Jarta Highlands, their mood somber, their thoughts now filled with apprehension. Gothjalk joined them, mere miles short of Besral, and though the Tidoni were dismayed to learn of Athgieri's fall, the rest of the Holy War were heartened. Here, on the very land that had birthed the latter prophet, the men of the Tusk had been reunited. Only one last task lay before them. Then, the morning they wound down the last of the Jardic Heights, they came to an abandoned Nansor villa at the end of the Sherazor Plains. Here the warrior prophet called a halt, though hours of daylight remained. The lords of the Holy War beseeched him to continue, so eager were they to at last lay eyes on the Holy City. Denying them, he took up residence behind the fortified walls. Esmanet begged him not to move. She braced her hands against his hard chest, then staring into his eyes, she slowly pressed down, taking him to his pelvis. He shuddered, and for a grinding instant, she felt herself welded to him in singular bliss. He came, and she followed, bucking about iron and wringing heat, crying out, "Thank you," she gasped in his ear afterward. "Thank you." It seemed she so rarely touched him anymore. He sat on the edge of the bed, and though his breath was heavy, she knew he was not winded. He was never winded. He stood, and she watched him walk naked across the polished floor to the elaborate laver carved into the sill of the opposing wall. In the gloom, the tripods painted him in orange and crimson hues. As he washed, his shadow fell bloated across the frescoed walls. She lay watching, admiring his ivory form, savoring the memory of him, slick between her thighs. She hugged tight the sheets, suddenly greedy for what little warmth they offered. She stared across the suite, recognizing in its lines memories of her former home, the Empire. Centuries previous, she knew some Patrodomos had coupled in this very room, his thoughts miraculously innocent of words like phanum or consult. He would have recognized Kianine, perhaps, but only as the name of an obscure desert people. Not just individuals, but entire ages, she realized, could be innocent of dreadful things. She thought of Serwe. The perpetual anxiousness returned. How had the joy of her new circumstances become so elusive? In her old life, she had often quizzed the priests who came to her, and in her darker moods, she had even presumed to school them in what she saw as their hypocrisy. With some, those unlikely to return, she had asked what could be missing from their faith for them to find solace in whores. "Strength," they sometimes answered. Several had even wept. But more often than not, they denied missing anything at all. After all, how could they be miserable when Inri Sejanus had claimed their hearts? "Many make that mistake," Kella said, standing at the side of the bed. Without thinking, she reached out and grasped his phallus, began stroking its head with her thumb. He knelt on the edge of the bed, and his great shadow encompassed her. A nimbus of gold outlined his mane.
blinking tears, she looked to him. Please, take me again. They think misery inconsistent with faith, he continued, and so they start to pretend. They act as others act, thinking they alone have doubts, they alone are weak. In the company of the joyous, they become desolate and hold themselves accountable for their own desolation. He became hard and long beneath her touch, curved like a strung bow. But I have you, she murmured. I lie with you. I bear your child. Kella smiled, gently disengaged her hand. He leaned forward to kiss her palm. I'm the answer, Esme, not the cure. Why was she crying? What was wrong with her? Please, she said, clutching his member once again, as though it were her only purchase, her only possible hold on this godlike man. Please take me. This one thing I can give. There's more, he said, drawing back the sheets and placing a shadowy hand upon her belly. So much more. His look was long and sad. Then he left her for Akamian and the secrets of the Gnosis. She lay awake for some time, listening to the fragments of arcane voice that surfaced from the stonework about her. Then, the gloom thickening as the braziers failed, she stretched naked across the sheets and drowsed, her soul circling about sorrow after sorrow. The death of Akamian, the death of Maimara. Nothing stayed dead in her life, her past least of all.
Walking between wards is easy, a voice hummed, when their author practices other arcana.
She awoke suddenly, if not completely, and through blinking eyes watched yet another man walk to the side of her bed. He was tall, dressed in a black cloak over a silvered brigandine. With relief, she realized, he was quite handsome. There was compensation of a different sort, and his shadow had hooked wings. She tumbled from the far side of the bed, shrank toward the far wall.
And to think, he said, that I thought 12 talents an outrage.
She tried to scream, but somehow he was there, pressed like a lover against her, his smooth hand clamped about her mouth. She felt the thick arch of him pressed against her buttocks. When he licked her ear, her body shuddered in treacherous delight.
How, he gasped, could the same peach command such different prices, Can the bruises be washed away, the juices sweetened?
His free hand roamed the planes of her body, and she could feel herself tense, not against him, but for, as though her desires were as easily molded as clay.
Or is it simply the vendor? It seemed that fire had stolen her breath.
Please, she gasped, take me. Stubble chafed the spit-softened skin below her ears. She knew that it was an illusion, but...
My children, he said, only imitate what they see.
She whimpered into his suffocating hand, tried to cry out even as her legs slackened to the touch of his probing fingers.
But me, he murmured in a voice that ran tickling over her skin, I take.